Hello, welcome to Illinois Radio Reader. Today is February 11th, Wednesday, and this is Lisa bringing you the News Gazette today. I hope you're having a great day so far. We're starting off, of course, on the front page where there's a bright, quite large picture today of a lot of fans in the stands for the Illinois game, and they are dressed in orange, and they all have these very bright yellow crazy wigs. And it says here under the picture, Orange Crush members pay tribute to the luscious mane adorning the head of Illinois forward Jake Davis Tuesday for Tuesday night's Big Ten men's basketball matchup between the number 8 Illini and Wisconsin of State at State Farm Center in Champaign. It was part of a Jake Davis wig giveaway night for students. The Badgers, although, spoiled the party with a 92-90 win in overtime. We'll get to that a little bit later. Another article on our front page is from Savoy by Jana Wiersema, and it is about rezoning sought for senior housing. 50-unit complex proposed on land just west of Aldi. A developer from the Chicagoland area is proposing to build independent senior housing on 2 acres of vacant land just west of Aldi. North Arrow Partners seeks to have the site raised from planned unit development legacy to moderate density multifamily residential to facilitate the project. The request will be on the consent agenda for the Village Board's regular meeting tonight. This is a great fill-in project that addresses some of those missing middle housing needs. The Village Administrator Andy Kornstrom said, the project meets the needs of the community all the while complementing neighboring developments, both residential and commercial. North Arrow Partners, which is based in Villa Park, describes itself as a full-service development, architectural and general contracting firm specializing in innovative multifamily communities. It's going to be, if we have your blessing and we get the financing for it, will be 50 units, partner and chief technical officer John Cronin told the board during a recent study session. The company is under contract to purchase the subject properties, and the development is contemplated to be 3 stories, said community planner Caitlin Kelly. She also noted that independent senior housing, as defined by local zoning ordinances, is not intensive specialty care. This is more age-restricted, semi-supportive housing, assistance with daily life activities, she said. When I spoke with someone from North Arrow, what was said was that there would be assistance with transportation and similar daily life activities, but again, not specialty assistance. She added that North Arrow Partners has several similar developments in their portfolio. The company's previous work includes Oakfield Place in Henry, Illinois, a 1-story building with 30 apartments for residents 55 years and older, plus amenities such as a fitness center and a community room with a kitchen. According to the Housing Authority of Champaign County, units at Oakfield Place are restricted to low-income individuals, and 10 of the units have project-based vouchers for rental assistance. Kelly wrote a report to the board that the U.S. Census Bureau's 2019 to 2023 American Community Survey found that approximately 60% of renters age 65 and older in Savoy were housing cost burdened, compared to 88.7% as recorded during the 2010 census. That means that they spend more than 30% of their monthly income on things like rent, utilities, and other similar housing-related expenses. That proportion has gone down seemingly since 2010, but it's still pretty substantial, she told the board, adding that the planned project would definitely go toward meeting a demonstrated need within the community. Also on the Village Board's consent agenda tonight, an agreement with the Illinois Commerce Commission to release funding for the Curtis Road Underpass Project. This agreement unlocks about $2.5 million in ICC funds for engineering, right-of-way acquisition, and utility relocation for the project. said Public Works Director Roland White. As we get closer to construction, we will come back with another ICC funding agreement to release the main $15.5 million of ICC funds. According to an email from White to state officials, which was included in the meeting packet, the total cost of the project is estimated at approximately $56.2 million. As of now, and based on preliminary estimates, we are not currently anticipating a funding gap, Kornstrom told the News Gazette. As you can imagine, projects this large are ever-evolving and numerous variables can come into play. But as I write this, we feel good about the funding for the project as it relates to project estimates. White wrote in a report to the board that the goal is still to bid out the project sometime in 2027. The board will also vote on a contract with Steve's Trucking and Company of Decatur to demolish four blighted buildings on land, surrounded by West Main Street, Wesley Avenue, West Church Street, and US 45 Dunlap Avenue. Village officials are partnering with Downtown Development Group to turn the site into a downtown square. This project will demolish all the remaining buildings of the downtown development site, with the exception of the metal-sided building, which is in decent condition, White told the board. It will be used for public work, cold storage, and potentially for a field office for the developer. Eventually, that building will be demolished also. While the contractor's bid was $98,651, the lowest of those submitted, the village staff recommended that the board authorize up to $120,000 for the work in order to provide a contingency. The contract will be paid using tax increment funds, staff said. And there's a picture here at the bottom of this article. North Arrow Partners, a development based in Villa Park, hopes to build a dependent senior housing on this vacant land west of Aldi in Savoy. At the bottom of our front page here today is an opinion piece by Jim Dye, and so we will continue with that. It's called Coach's Long Run of Hoops Success Began Locally. He's the son of a coach who has a son who is a coach as the head men's basketball coach at Southern Illinois University in Carbondale. Scott Nagy recently got the 600th win of his 30-plus year career, but in Champaign-Urbana, he's better known as a local boy who made good. A key player on Champaign Centennial's 1984 run to the state tournament, Nagy played college ball in Mississippi and then was a graduate assistant for Fighting Illini head coach Lou Henson and alongside his father, longtime Henson assistant, Dick Nagy. He then embarked on his long road to 600, first working briefly as an assistant coach before becoming a head coach at the age of 28 in South Dakota State. Now 59, Nagy is not looking back on his previous success, but ahead to building a program that is going to sustain success at SIUC, just like he did at South Dakota State and Wright State in Dayton, Ohio. Indeed, he said, getting his 600th win January 28th against Northern Iowa was a little bit anticlimactic. I wanted it to happen earlier, said Nagy, who jokes that coaching keeps him young and losing games keeps me humble. Someone else didn't want it to happen at all. Nagy's father urged his son not to go into coaching, suggesting instead a career in business. He just knew it was a hard business, but I went into it knowing, Nagy said. But success built on the backs of good recruits and excellent assistants came early. In Nagy's first 3 years at South Dakota State, the Jackrabbits went 75-13 and competed in three NCAA Division II tournaments. That success continued until SDS decided to jump to the Division I level, requiring that Nagy called a brutal transition. What he called a brutal transition against bigger schools and stronger competition. His team went 25-62 in the first 3 years at Division I. But the Jackrabbits went to 5 postseason tournaments, including 3 NCAA Division I tournaments, in the final 5 years of his 20-plus year run at SDS. Moving to Wright State and Dayton, Ohio, Nagy, with his wife Jamie and their 5 children, experienced culture shock after living so long in South Dakota. "I had never resided in Ohio. I didn't know anything about Wright State," said Nagy. Compared to South Dakota, where Nagy said he was a big fish in a small sea, life was the opposite in the more urban Ohio area. But Nagy's team did well. Wright State compiled a 16-7-92 record over 8 years and went to 2 Division I NCAA tournaments. 2 years ago, SIUC came calling, and he and his wife, who grew up in Decatur, were interested because they would have been closer with connections to their families. "We are Illinois people," said Nagy. Success hasn't come nearly as fast as Nagy would like at SIUC. The Salukis were 14-19 last year and were 10-13 before their February 6th home game against Murray State. Despite the occasional frustrations, Nagy said he's grateful that I've been able to coach this long, as well for his experience growing up in Champaign. He said he occasionally comes back to visit, principally to see the family of Barbara and the late Anthony Butch Hurges, with whom he lived for a long time in high school. Other than his own teams, Nagy said he doesn't pay a lot of attention to college basketball in his off time. "I get enough of that. I'd rather watch a movie," he said. But one thing Nagy has noticed this season is the terrific play of Illini freshman sensation Keaton Wagler. Nagy said the Salukis tried to lure Wagler to SIUC and had him on campus for a visit. "We were in the mix, probably until Illinois came in," Nagy said. "I thought he was an NBA guy. I really did." And there's a picture here of Scott Nagy, former graduate assistant for Fighting Illini head coach Lou Henson, as he leads South Dakota State against Michigan in March of 2013. And the last article on the front page of the News Gazette today is episode 19 of News Gazette Radio, as heard on News Gazette Radio, airing from 4 to 5 p.m. Monday through Thursday on WDWS 1400 a.m. And there's a streaming online at thenewsgazette.com. And there's bullet points here, and I will just read each one. The first one said, "You've read his behind-the-scenes stories of Farm Aid 1, Ozzy Osbourne's trip to CU, and Bruce Springsteen's 1981 tour stop. In the pages of the News Gazette on Tuesday, listeners to the News Gazette Radio got to hear former Assembly Hall events manager John Graham recount some of his most memorable building moments. The short list as follows. Loudest concert? You'd think it was Van Halen, ZZ Top, but the loudest was George Thorogood and the Delaware Destroyers, who registered the highest reading on the building's decibel meter. Next, most down-to-earth star, Red Skelton, who Graham joined on a trip to Target before a show here, and lo and behold, I'm walking down the aisle with Red Skelton. And there's my mom. I say, hey, Mom. She turns purple because Red Skelton was a big star, and Red Skelton doesn't miss a beat in that voice he had. Oh, ma'am, I'm so happy to meet you. Your son told me everything about you. I told him nothing, but he was great. Best sound, the Talking Heads. Very precise. It was a combination of the lyrics and the music that made it work. Most unique rider, Neil Diamond, whose team would send crews to every arena hosting a show to go over every single detail, every part of that contract rider, 3 to 6 months beforehand. The thing he witnessed once and never again, when we did the Grateful Dead. There was a young lady that came in as soon as the show started. She took all of her clothes off and started dancing on the arena floor. The cops came to me and said, what do you want to do about that? I said, do you really want to go down and try to stop her with 14,000 people here? Next, son John entered play Tuesday as the Big Ten's 8th leading scorer, putting up 18.5 points a game for the Wisconsin Badgers, but a game of horse It's Dad Lou Henson's era Illini sharpshooter, Glenn Blackwell, who's king of the court. I'm the master who taught him how to do it all, the elder Blackwell said with a laugh back on the campus where he started for three NCAA tournament teams. The pride of Highland Park, Michigan, got his facilities tour from Kendall Bostick, reminisced about his greatest hits, every win over Michigan and Michigan State, and marveled at the makeup of Brad Underwood's bunch. I was just talking to KB, Kenny Battle, last night, and we were both laughing. These boys are long and big. Last one, happy 10th birthday to Sydney's Reagan Schluter, who joined the show to discuss how she'll spend the big day by belting out the national anthem at tonight's Illini women's game, followed by a special meal, Monocles. She said a big fan who flew with the women's team to Florida State in November and hopes to one day play for Shauna Green. Reagan is usually poised personified when singing a song she first performed in front of a crowd at one of her dad Leroy's Gordyville tractor pulls. I don't normally get nervous, she said. Let's continue on to Section A8 under our communities with an article about Champaign County Coroner, from the coroner by Jana Wiersema. Driver in Monday's Homer accident is identified. From Homer, an 82-year-old woman who died in a one-vehicle accident has been identified as a Newman resident. Karen L. Parr was pronounced dead at the scene of the accident at 1:08 p.m. Monday, said Champaign County Coroner Lori Brower. An autopsy has been scheduled. Parr was the sole occupant of the involved vehicle, which sustained extensive damage due to the crash and subsequent fire, the Champaign County Sheriff's Office said. The Sheriff's Office, along with the Homer Fire Department, was dispatched to 736 North Country Road, 2500 East, at approximately 12:14 p.m. Monday for an accident with injuries, said Lieutenant Kurt Apperson. The report officials received was that an SUV hit a tree and caught on fire, he told the News Gazette. The Sheriff's Office said that their initial investigation indicated that the car was driving north on County Road 2500 East, about a quarter mile north of County Road 700 North, when it gradually veered off the roadway to the east. The vehicle traveled approximately 100 feet before striking a tree located in the ditch area near the 700 block of County Road 2500 East, officials said. A passerby who did not see the accident occur came across the scene and tried to help Parr, the sheriff's office said. This individual removed Parr from the car, which was filled with smoke, and administered CPR, but stopped once they determined that she was dead. Not long after this, the car became fully engulfed in flames and was found to be a total loss, the sheriff's office said. Continuing on this page, an article from the Champaign Police. One teen dead, another injured after Monday night shooting. A Monday night shooting left one teen dead and another in the hospital. Champaign County Coroner Lori Brower identified the deceased as Tariq Porter, 17, of Champaign. He was pronounced dead at Carl Hospital at 7:18 p.m. An autopsy has been scheduled. The investigation is ongoing and no arrests have been made at this time, Champaign police said. Officials were dispatched at 6:43 p.m. Monday to the 800 block of South Mattis Avenue after receiving a report of shots fired. Porter, who was found inside a vehicle, suffered from multiple gunshot wounds. Officers and personnel from the fire department provided aid until he could be taken to the hospital. Then, at about 7 p.m., police received word that a 19-year-old male with a gunshot wound had arrived at the emergency department via personal transport. This individual, also from Champaign, was hospitalized and in stable condition as of Tuesday morning, according to Champaign police. Officers are still canvassing the area near the scene for witnesses and video footage. At this time, Champaign police are working to determine the facts of this case, police said. Investigators are pursuing every lead and are seeking assistance from the community to confirm what happened that led to the gunfire. Police ask anyone with tips to call the department at 217-351-4545, and arrangements can be made for information to be shared anonymously. And there's an article from Danville about the Village Mall. Auction continues through today. by Jennifer Bailey, the Village Mall's online auction had a current bid of $900,000 as of Tuesday afternoon. However, the listing also said the reserve set by the seller had yet to be met. The auction is to end at noon today. The online auction had been moved back to February from January to garner more interested bidders. Being auctioned off is the 281,670 square foot, 8% leased and closed interior mall site at 2917 North Vermilion Street. The starting bid, $700,000, and the auction listing had more than 1.6 million views on the website. Interested bidders included a Midwest developer, a private investigator, and a couple properties in Danville. When the auction ends, if the seller agrees to the sale price, the winning bidder will be approved. Funding approved, and there will be, a contract for the buyer to sign, officials involved with the auction have said. Then there's a 30-day closing period, which also can be extended 10 to 15 more days. New information listed for the mall auction included the identities of the clothing store and movie theater chain allegedly interested in the space at the mall, Beals & Company and Golden Ticket Cinema. Five Below has also expressed interest in the space in the mall. The mall auction doesn't include the spaces of Slumberland, Shoe Sensation, County Market, Pet Supply Plus, or Ross Dress for Less. The mall is being auctioned off again as two stores recently closed, Dunham Sports and Bath & Body Works. Current mall tenants include Hibbett Sporting Goods, City Trends, and Danville Area Community College's Barber School, which has been in an inactive state for new students due to the resignation of instructor Terry Gard. No new student cohorts is currently enrolled. Messages to mall management have not been returned. Danville Mayor Ricky Williams Jr. said that the city doesn't receive communication from the mall owner. Williams said he was disappointed the city wasn't contacted about the properties being put up for sale again. The city had offered incentive packages to help with the redevelopment of the mall. And also, next to this article, another article from Danville about the Chick-fil-A fast food chain signs lease for Danville location by Jennifer Bailey. Danville officials received word last week that Chick-fil-A has signed a lease to bring the restaurant to the former Red Lobster site on North Vermilion Street. Danville Mayor Ricky Williams Jr. said they received a message from the developer that Chick-fil-A has now taken the next step. Williams said there remains a due diligence period during which the chain could still reconsider. However, the city is currently is reviewing architectural plans. Williams said he's excited that the city is attracting another restaurant. It's the hardest franchise to get in the country right now, he said. Williams also is hopeful that the fast food restaurant, which specializes in chicken sandwiches, will spur other development in the city. Red Lobster, 3217 North Vermilion Street, closed in May of 2024, with the site still remaining vacant. The Danville City Council in December approved an agreement with Solutions Group Real Estate for the restaurant development. The city would demolish the Red Lobster building at a cost of about $80,000 and prepare the site for the new restaurant in addition to reimbursing $300,000 in redevelopment costs. If Chick-fil-A ends up not developing at the site, the city would look to work with other restaurant brands. The first choice is Chick-fil-A, but there are other options too, Williams said in December, adding that the city also has had multiple conversations with and at that time had preliminary designs from Chick-fil-A. Williams said that once building plans are finalized and approved, then the city would move forward with demolition of the former Red Lobster building. Development partner Josh Gidjo said that Northbrook Real Estate Company identified the property about 3 years ago. They were to acquire the property before the end of 2025 and had a very quality long-term tenant, he said last year. Let's now go to an opinion piece by J. Mark Powell in his Holy Cow History with the title, The President's Cow is Missing. And there we have pictures of beautiful spotted cow called Pauline Wayne. President William Howard Taft's Holstein cow with her new calf, Big Bill, named in the president's honor. The article reads, "It's mostly been a dog's life at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, with some notable felines also prowling the halls of the White House in its illustrious history. But just over a century ago, the Washington Press Corps was fascinated by a 1,500-pound member of the extended first family who stole America's heart. She was Pauline Wayne, a Holstein cow who captured the media's fancy in a way no other presidential animal has before or since. Yet, at the height of her fame, she came dangerously close to an unplanned trip to the slaughterhouse. In early 20th century, there was no dairy in the nation's capital. Many Washingtonians kept a cow on their property, adding a hefty dose of methane to all the gas coming out of the capital. The White House was no exception. Cows had been there ever since John Adams moved into the place in 1800. So when William Howard Taft arrived in 1909, there was nothing unusual about his cow, Mooly Wooly, grazing on the south lawn. She was responsible for keeping the White House supplied with fresh milk and butter, which, given the 300-pound Taft's legendary appetite, was no small task. But Mooly Wooly died suddenly in 1910, supposedly after eating too many oats. Her death was national news. The Washington Post scolded. She had never been instructed by experts that oats are for horses. Foreshadowing combative White House advisor and former Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel's maxim, never let a crisis go to waste, U.S. Senator Isaac Stevenson, a Republican from Wisconsin, seized the moment of Mooly Wooly's passing, Wisconsin is a dairy state after all, and sent the Tafts a prize 4-year-old Holstein. Pauline Wayne became an immediate media sensation. Her arrival at Washington's Union Station was even covered by the New York Times. It turned out that Pauline was expecting. She soon gave birth to a bull named Big Bill in honor of the rotund Taft, which was sent to live on a Maryland farm. It was all covered in breathless detail. Reporters dubbed Pauline the Queen of the Capital Cows. A 2015 profile of a famous bovine in the Atlantic said the Post in particular had something of an obsession with Pauline. Covering her like U.S. Weekly would cover a Kardashian. That newspaper ran more than 20 stories mentioning Pauline between 1910 and 1912. Pauline was more than the Taft's dairy source. She became their beloved family pet. So when the White House received an invitation that would allow her fans to see her in person, Taft happily obliged. Pauline was the star attraction at the 1911 International Dairymen's Exposition in Milwaukee. Little bottles of her famous milk sold as souvenirs for 50 cents, but she almost didn't make it there. To everyone's horror, Pauline disappeared. Somewhere on the way, the White House issued a frantic APB for the bovine VIP. It seemed a railroad crew had mistakenly attached her special car to a group of regular cattle cars bound for the Chicago stockyards. Pauline was spotted in the nick of time, sparing her, ribs and all, sorry I couldn't help it, from the butcher's block. After that close call, Taft declined all future invitations, but Pauline remained her rock star appeal. The Post bizarrely printed two different interviews with her. Apparently either she spoke English or the reporters were fluent in cow speak. A stage producer even asked if he could feature Pauline in his play. The offer made Taft laugh, but the answer was a firm no. Taft wasn't laughing when Woodrow Wilson defeated him for re-election in 1912. Despite the fame, life in the presidential fishbowl hadn't been good for Pauline. She was in declining health, so the White House announced in February of 1913 she was going back to where it all began. The Times reported President Taft believes that if she is taken back to Wisconsin and put on Senator Stevenson's farm again, her youthful vigor will revive, and eventually it did. Pauline Wayne made one final claim to the White House fame. She was the last cow to live on the premises. From the Wilsons on, the executive mansion's milk came from a dairy, not a trip to the barn. It seems strangely quaint now that a simple cow once commanded so much interest, and yet it was deeply humanizing, too. It reminded everyday Americans that their president got his milk the same way that they did. And we're going to take a break now with this half of the News Gazette. I will be back shortly.